Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today, I have the distinct pleasure to welcome as our guest, Mr. Richard Mayberry. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Folks, everyone in America, actually everyone in the world, should know about Mr. Mayberry and his investment newsletter called the Early Warning Report. And particularly, I'd like everyone to become familiar with his excellent Uncle Eric series of books. Now, I would say that Richard Mayberry, in my opinion, is the most important author for introducing what we call on Radio Free Market reality economics and more real history to young and old alike. Later in the show, I'll be talking with Richard more about his various books, but first we're going to present the very timely material presented in just two of his books, Ancient Rome and How It Affects Us Today, and his book World War One, where we'll be focusing on some of the deadly ideas that we have inherited and that are all too commonly shared that lead us into war. So we've got a lot to cover, so let's begin with my first question. Richard, in your really excellent book, Ancient Rome and How It Influences Us Today, you point out that history repeats, but then ask the important question, why do we forget our history? So, Richard, why do we forget?
Well, there's probably quite a few reasons. One of them is that people, the way human beings understand their world is by building mental models of that world. For instance, when you walk through your house for the first time, you notice where the rooms are and the hallway and all the other features in the house, and your mind begins to memorize what that house is like, so that within a 2 or 3 days of living in that house, you've got the whole place completely memorized. And if somebody were to walk you into the house in the middle of the night with all the lights turned off, and then they would suddenly turn the lights on, you would instantly know exactly where you were and where you were in relation to all the other rooms in the house, because you have this mental model in your head. Well, you go through your whole life constructing models of how the world works. A blueprint of an automobile is a model of that automobile. And people are not taught models that enable them to understand history. Mostly, they aren't taught economics and they aren't taught law. And so they have no real understanding of what's going on. The history is just this big collection of trivia. They can't decide which facts are important and which ones aren't. And it's mostly, to most people, I think, a very boring thing because they have no ability to understand it because they have no models.
Right. So you make the point also that those that understand history have a distinct advantage over those who do not, yet, as you point out, very few people understand what you call the Roman disease. Do you mean by this that we overlook how connected our culture and thinking is to the aspects of ancient Rome?
There is, an aspect of the Roman disease is the Pax Romana. Everybody is taught in school, I should say in the government-controlled schools, that there was this 200-year period during the era of the Roman Empire in which the Roman Empire or the Roman government sat on the world like a lid on a pressure cooker, and it controlled everything and kept everybody in line, and so things were peaceful and there was a great deal of progress and life was wonderful. And so everybody's taught that. So everybody, at least in Western culture, let's say Europe and the United States, they want to return to the Pax Romana. Well, who wouldn't? It was such a wonderful time. The problem is, it wasn't. There were all kinds of wars and assassinations and revolutions. There's
going
a huge
on.
Amount
so,
of violence.
You know, I'm going to have to interrupt you right now because we're going to take our first break. But when we come back, folks, we'll be talking with Richard Mayberry about the Roman disease and ancient Rome and what it teaches us today. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, speaking with Mr. Richard Mayberry. So just before the break, Richard, you were talking about the Pax Romana and this Roman disease that we've all been basically infected with. How many cultural signs of this are overlooked by us in daily life that are part of what you call our mental furniture?
Oh, it's really fascinating to me how much of Roman culture is in our culture that we don't even recognize anymore. And one of them is the architecture. It's very common for courthouses, for instance, or legislative buildings, other sorts of governmental buildings, to be built with a Roman architecture, you know, with the pillars that go all the way around. Yeah, kind of copies of the Roman pantheon and other mm-hmm. sorts of big Roman buildings. And we just kind of associate our own culture's law with Roman law because the architecture reflects that. And it goes beyond the general design of the buildings. The decorations on the buildings say so much that we don't know is being said to us. If you look at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., on the front of the throne that Lincoln is sitting on, there are two fasces. Now, these are bundles of rods bound together, and what they symbolize is fascism. Before World War II, fascism was openly acknowledged as a wonderful system, and Americans were taught that fascism was a thing that we should admire, and that's why Lincoln was associated with the fascists that are right there. He's actually touching them. It's those sorts of things that have kind of whitewashed the Roman way of looking things and injected it into our culture without us even realizing it's happening.
Right. And I'm going to jump ahead and say that in your book you also point out that Latin on our money, the laurel leaves that were part of the ceremonial accoutrements in the Roman Empire are also part of our culture that we don't notice. This is that mental furniture that we are just subconsciously allowing to be there without really recognizing its influence on us. So let's talk right. about Roman law. Mm-hmm. You know, what is that?
That's a very good question. Nobody ever really asks that I know of. I think the reason it's not asked is that the answer is that Roman law is nothing. There are no essential principles or anything underlying Roman law. It's just a lot of smoke. And what it amounts to is the government should do whatever appears necessary. That's all of Roman law. And so the U.S. government and the governments in Europe and pretty much all around the world over time have absorbed that attitude that they're just supposed to do whatever they think is necessary. And that sounds funny. I mean, it is a kind of a funny thing when you first bring it up, but when you think about what it leads to, for instance, in the 1930s and 40s, the German Nazi Party was roaming all over Europe murdering Jews because they thought it was necessary. And there was nothing in Roman law to stop them because in Roman law, your rights come to you from the government. And what the government gives, it can take away.
Right. And so, and not simply from God or being born, as we have been brought up in America, they are, you know, our God-given rights, as we were taught, and that the state is supreme. And this overall philosophy is what, you know, generally we would call today, I guess, statism as the as a encapsulating kind of philosophy. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, you know, here at Radio Free Market, we call that king is law, and that we live under the whim of the lawmakers. And one of the other aspects that I remember you bringing out was that the unification is a supreme aspect of this entire process, where the culture of a country cannot really allow too much differentiation. Unification is more important. Mm-hmm. And our politicians, you also mentioned that they make their decisions based on this Roman model where laws constantly change. But this puts a real serious problem for us, particularly those of us that are business people, where the rules are constantly changing. And, this is also very evident in our money. Interest rates are centrally controlled and regulations are constantly changing. Could you comment on that for a second?
As far as the unification point, this is really one of my hot buttons. What does the word unify really mean? I mean, it sounds so good, but what does it really mean? Well, you can see what it really means if you go to Hawaii, and you'll find statues of King Kamehameha all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and Hawaiians are taught in their government-controlled schools to admire King Kamehameha because he unified Hawaii. Well, then if you get into the history of what he actually did, well, what unifying means is that he told everybody that they had to obey whatever he thought they should do, or else he would kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what unification means, is that you've got a single government that gives commands to everyone, and somebody who decides he wants to live his life his own way is going to be killed. So unification is tyranny all by itself. The idea that it is a good thing is simply foisted onto us through the school systems, which are owned or controlled by government agencies.
I'm going to talk more with you a little bit about the education system, but
okay.
You point out that America was founded on a completely different concept called common law.
Mm-hmm.
And we at Radio Free Market, we refer to that as law is king, as opposed to the Roman model where king is law. And what we've been seeing is this constant erosion of law is king and being replaced by Roman law, as you call it, or what we call king is law. These Roman law politicians that we have right now, they say that law is whatever they say it is, and they can change tomorrow. And it's particularly egregious when the president ignores Congress and just issues laws by executive order. So why is this? Why is power itself such the problem?
Well, we have to define what political power is, and what it is the privilege of using brute force on persons who have not harmed anyone. That's what sets government apart from all other institutions. There's no church or charity or business or any other kind of private institution that's allowed to use force except in self-defense. Only government can use coercion, brute force. Only government can send men with guns to your front door to force you to obey its laws when you haven't harmed anyone. When you think about what political power is, it's really easy to see why it corrupts. Writers all through the ages have remarked at how political power corrupts, that you can get a perfectly wonderful person, a very honorable person who is very intelligent and very well educated, and you put him into a position of power and he turns into a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody's, if you read enough history, you've noticed that happening over and over and over again. If you give somebody the privilege of using force on persons who haven't harmed anyone and you tell him he has a right to do that to people, it's going to mess up his mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we keep seeing.
Yep. Well, you make the point in your book, I think it's really an important point for everyone to hear, that it's been cultivated in our culture from ancient days. This is really something that comes down to us over and over again, that those that have power, that are holding power, have unique, even divine inspiration and abilities that the common person doesn't have, or magical powers like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I like to mention that, titled this show for our listeners, that ancient Rome is America's blind spot, and Roman law or common law, what is it that we're really teaching in the school systems to our our children?
Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about common law?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about common law and you know, what is it that we're actually teaching in our school system. We got a little about a minute and a half on this segment, but please go ahead.
Common law is what the American legal system used to be, and it's what the legal system in Britain used to be. America inherited it from Britain. And common law is the assumption that your rights and responsibilities come from your creator, not from the government, but from your creator. And that always leaves the question, well, how do we know what rights we got from the creator? Where is this written down? Well, the common law was, very briefly, a system in which the judges extracted from the prevailing religions, all of them, the principles that they all held in common. And so the common law was the enforcement of the rules that all the religions held in common. And there's really only two of them. One is...
And we're going to pick those up actually a little bit later, because we unfortunately have another break that we have to take right now. I hate interrupting you, I have to tell you. But please,
no problem.
Please hang on, everybody. We'll be right back after the break with Richard Mayberry, and we'll be talking more about common law. You won't want to miss this. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. So this is Michael McKay with Radio Free Market, and I am talking with Mr. Richard Mayberry. And so, Richard, you were just talking about common law. Please continue that.
Right. The common law, what would happen is, let's put it this way, what did happen in history is the Roman Empire fell, and Western Europe fell into what was called the Dark Ages, and there was no real law at all left. The feudal lords who ruled Europe, there were hundreds or thousands of them, you know, they didn't really care very much about what went on as long as the tax revenues kept rolling in. And so the people were left with no legal structure, no way to work out problems of a legal nature. And what the judges did was they extracted the rules that are commonly taught by all religions. And one rule is, do all you have agreed to do. And that became the basis of contract law, when that enables you to organize and run the economy. The other rule is, do not encroach on other persons or their property. That's the basis of tort law and some criminal law, you know, all the laws against murder and theft and so forth come under that rule. Do not encroach on other persons or their property. Well, now, I should point out, you know, a lot of people refer to those as Richard Mayberry's two laws or Mayberry's two laws. They aren't really my laws. I just kind of extracted them from common law by studying the common law clear back into the Middle Ages. The judges who came up with them, we have no idea who they were, but they were really brilliant people. And the common law system grew up from those two laws. Every time a judge had someone come before him with some sort of legal dispute, he would refer to the two laws, and his decision would become a precedent for later decisions. And that body of precedents became the body of common law. It was a living thing that was evolving year after year, century after century. And it is what the American Declaration of Independence and Constitution were built on, is this assumption that your rights come from your creator, whatever you conceive the creator to be, and that there is no human authority, and this is the big one, there's no human authority who has rights that come from your creator.
That's in direct contrast to the Roman law.
Right, and the Roman law says, your rights come to you from the government, and what the government gives, it can take away. The government can do anything to you that it wants, essentially. In America,
so when these were this common law was widely practiced, what was the result in society?
Oh my goodness! You know, one of my most favorite charts, economic charts, is just a single line, and it shows the standard of living of the typical individual in Western civilization. Just, you know, how good is your life? And by measuring all sorts of things, speed of transportation, the amount and the quality of the food, all sorts of things. Well, that line, from as far back as you want to go, let's say 10,000 years, is almost flat. There's almost no progress for thousands of years until you hit 1776. Hmm. And then suddenly that line turns and goes almost vertical. There is this enormous explosion of prosperity that happens after 1776, because suddenly legal systems in America and then shortly after that in Europe begin to be based on those two fundamental laws, and life gets rational, and you can plan ahead, and you can invest capital in various business enterprises without worrying about it being stolen by the government. It's miraculous. I mean, it's just astounding what you see in the economy after those two laws are put in force by the American founders after the Revolution of 1776. Almost everything I'm sorry, say again?
No, please, go ahead.
Almost everything we have today comes from the fact that the founders created a legal system based on those two laws, the Constitution again, and the Declaration of Independence. You can measure this yourself. Just walk around your house and make a list of everything that was developed before 1776 and everything that was developed after 1776, and you will find almost everything you have was developed after the founders began to enforce those two laws on the government.
You know, I want to interrupt you right now because, again, we only have a little over a minute left, but I want to insert this really important comment, I think. One of the earliest shows that we did on Radio Free Market, now we have over 100 shows in our archives. One of the earliest shows we did with a young professor from Memphis by the name of Art Carden, and the show is The Myths of Capitalism's History, and Art points out that prior to that period of 1776, 1750, 1776, you would be born expecting no economic progress in your life.
That's
and all
right.
of a sudden there was this explosion.
That's
and I think
right.
your comments really address that dramatically.
Yeah, and I think one of the most wonderful things about this is you can test that yourself. You make that list. Walk around your house and make that list before 1776 and after 1776. And you will be amazed. It's like the world was invented in 1776.
That's a great way for us to segue into the next segment. Richard, we're going to come back after the break, and we're going to start talking about some of these deadly ideas that lead to war. And I encourage everyone to stay put because you're not going to want to miss this. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. This is Radio Free Market. And welcome back, everyone. This is Michael McKay, and I have with me Mr. Richard Mayberry. And just before the break, we were talking about Roman law and common law. And now I would like to bring up a couple of concepts that are introduced in your book, World War One, where you list actually 10 deadly ideas that lead to war. Now, I recommend this book, and we don't have time to cover all 10 of these, obviously. But the first one that I really want us to cover, and maybe the only one that we can really get into, is this concept of fascism. So, Richard, first let's discuss your definition of fascism, which is, I find, really very useful and is actually quite different than merely state control of production, which is the common definition that we hear economists and historians refer to. So please,
okay.
I give the floor to you.
Okay. The word fascism comes from the word fasces, which we talked about earlier, a bundle of rods bound together with a rope or something. And attached to that bundle of rods is an axe or a spear. And what that means is that is this idea of unification, you know, that the whole realm is unified under a single government, and if you don't do what you're told, the axe or the spear will be used on you. And now, during the days of the Roman Empire, the Roman officials, especially the tax collectors, would go from town to town accompanied by some army troops, and they would be carrying a fasces, and that was the symbol. When this guy came into town, it meant you are under the central government, and if you don't do what you're told, you're going to be dead. So the legal principle behind fascism is that right and wrong, well, that truth is just a matter of opinion, and therefore right and wrong are just matters of opinion. And therefore, the government should do whatever appears necessary. No exceptions and no limits. And that's what you saw in operation in the 1940s and 1930s in World War II when the Jews, for instance, were being wiped out in Europe. That was fascism in operation. The government was doing what it thought was necessary. And the justification was, you know, right and wrong are just matters of opinion.
I want to interrupt you because you mentioned earlier when we were talking about fascism earlier that prior to World War II, fascism was considered a respectable philosophy.
Right.
And, you know, most Americans, I think, believe that fascism just kind of suddenly popped up in the 20th century. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's fascinating. In America, in the East, where the older buildings are, you'll occasionally find fascies on the buildings as decorations and on some of the statues and other sorts of architecture. The fascies will be displayed. We talked earlier about the one on the Lincoln Memorial. Or there's two on the Lincoln Memorial, actually. In the House in Congress in Washington, D.C., there are two fascies on the wall right up in front of the house.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's amazing. They're big, too. You know, they're like 6 feet high.
Oh, jeez, oh, jeez.
And, yeah, and you can look it up on the Internet. Just look up House of Representatives, and you can see the fascies right up there up front because it was regarded as a good thing. And, you know, World War II and the Nazis in Germany suddenly, you know, nobody puts fascies on their buildings anymore, and they've disappeared from more modern architecture.
So they weren't really trying to do anything new. They were just trying to be, as you point out, more effective.
Yes, right. It's amazing to me how fascism runs through practically the whole federal government now, the Federal Reserve especially. I mean, it's comical. These people think that they actually have both the ability and the right to change interest rates.
Right.
I mean, just they reach down into the economy and they just change interest rates like they're God and they know what interest rates ought to be. I mean, it's astounding
right.
to me.
Yeah, we pointed out in other shows that, you know, interest rates are really the price of money. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's a market function. That's not a government fiat function.
Right. How else are you going to know what interest rates ought to be other than just let people bid against each other for the various forms of financial instruments and find out what the consensus is?
I want to go back to this fascism topic.
Okay.
And, you know, in your recent newsletter, which, by the way, folks, if you want, in my opinion, the very best investment newsletter that's out there, you need to check out Richard Mayberry's Early Warning Report. I've been a subscriber for many years. That's my full disclosure, and it has been extremely meaningful for me and my family. And in this most recent issue that you just put out, the November-December 2011 issue, you bring up this topic of values clarification, which was a system in the U.S. education system back in the 1970s when you and your wife were teachers at that particular time. Can you tell us a little bit more about this values clarification idea?
Yeah, actually, it's still out there. I don't think it's as formalized, and I don't think that it's very recognizable anymore, but the teachers who are teaching today were taught values clarification, and they may not have been told that when they were kids.
So was this a course that you actually had to take as a teacher?
Right. Yes, the teachers got instructions in how to teach values clarification, and then they taught it to the kids. It was an experiment, and still is an experiment, that the government-controlled schools imposed on millions and millions of kids all over the country. And, you know, as far as I know, nobody ever told the parents, well, this is what values clarification is, and this is what we're doing to your kid. It was just another one of those cases of the government using children as guinea pigs in the schools. Mm-hmm. Big experiment.
You know, I'm looking at your newsletter right now, and I found this point that you brought out that in your teacher's manual that you got from 1973, it said, and pardon me for stealing your thunder for a second, quote, this is from your teacher's manual, values are nebulous concepts formed in the cradle and modified by experience, felt differently by every person, and we cannot truly teach values. Holy cow.
Right.
So they're just a matter of opinion.
Yeah, exactly. That's right in the front of the teacher's manual for the values clarification course. And what values clarification was is the act of teaching the kids that right and wrong are just matters of opinion.
What's been the cultural fallout of that since this, you know, I know there's got to be studies that have been done that indicate the impact this has had on American children over the years. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, that's actually a lot of what that article in Early Warning Report is about. The reason I put it in there is that there's a new book out by a sociologist from Notre Dame who studied the effects of the decline in ethics among the young. And what he found was that he studied people age 18 to 23, and what he found was that two-thirds of them do not know how to tell the difference between right and wrong.
It's an amazing comment. Yeah, I'm looking at your, I found that part in your newsletter again, and the name of that book, folks, is Lost in Transition by Notre Dame sociologist Christian Smith.
Right.
Yeah.
And Smith was, you know, just shocked, and everybody who sees the results is shocked. But if you were a teacher in the 1970s, like my wife and I were, you're not shocked. You saw it coming. There were a lot of teachers who referred to values clarification as values obfuscation. They saw
That's
back
amazing.
Then. Yeah, they
I
saw
like this
back
term,
then.
Values obfuscation, that is actually a clearer thing. Pardon me again, Richard. I'm going to go ahead and read this thing that you put in your newsletter that's a quote from one of these young people that summarized what this really, the impact that this had on one of these 18 to 23-year-olds that was studied in this book. The quote is, when asked about values, the young person said, I mean, I guess, what makes something right is how I feel about it. But different people feel different in different ways, so I couldn't speak on behalf of anyone else as to what's right and wrong. Holy cow.
And I think if you look, this year, 2011, just look back a few months and look at all the riots that have broken out. I think there's a very high probability, this is my opinion, but I'm pretty sure, there's a very high probability the people who are looting and burning are people who were taught values clarification.
Right. There's no respect for people's property rights. They feel like if you have more, in many cases, there's quite. In fact, we just aired a show that, in fact, the week prior to this show being aired, which focuses on this these protesters who, in many cases, are not respecting people's property rights and not really caring whether or not you own something. They feel like they should have it just because you have it.
Yeah.
And that is actually really the same definition as fascism. Everything goes.
Yeah, right. The people who have the power should do whatever they think is necessary. Contrast this terrible, terrible situation with the old common law, where the rules were hard and fast, the fundamental rules. Now, when you get on the perimeter of the common law, where there was still need for advancement, you know, things were not so clear. But essentially, the everyday life of the individual, the core decisions he was making every day, always went back to those two fundamental laws, and the individual knew the difference between right and wrong. Mm-hmm. One thing you do is you always do what you agree to do, and the other thing you do is you never encroach on other persons or their property. And that was just a solid line that everybody knew they weren't supposed to cross, and it was taught in the schools. The average individual had a pretty good understanding of common law because it was a very simple, easy-to-understand system. And you contrast that now with this situation where two-thirds of the young people don't know how to tell the difference between right and wrong.
This is such an important thing. You know, I meant to mention earlier when you brought up the two laws that when I first read your book, which I, again, folks, I want to recommend this other book by Richard Mayberry, Whatever Happened to Justice, as well as his Introduction to Economics, which is Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, two of the most important books I think you can have either your children to read or yourself if you feel like you don't really understand economics. I think these are absolutely important books for anyone to read. But what I did for our family is I went ahead and photocopied the pages or the page where you had the two laws, and I cut them out and I hung them up all over our house. And because I had a young daughter at the time who's now going into college, and I wanted her to have that understood, that those are the two most important rules that she needs to get in her consciousness. So folks, you really do yourself and your family a favor. Anyone you care about, share those particular books with anyone and everyone that you know, and I think you'll be doing them and your entire community a great favor. You know, Richard, we only have about 3.5 minutes left on this segment, and then we're going into the end of our show. But I would like to touch on how this gets in motion, how fascism actually moves around the world, and how it becomes institutionalized a little bit more, because obviously, this is directly related to political power. So I've got a couple of questions I'll throw at you. You can answer them in any sequence you like. But is fascism winning as the dominant system around the world? And the second question is, how about political power? You know, tell us more about this love of political power as being a deadly idea.
Okay. Now, is fascism winning? I think that throughout the 20th century, it most certainly was winning, and I think that up until, let's say, 2008, it was still winning, and I was pretty pessimistic at that time, but by golly, in the last 3 years or so, oh my gosh, there's been such a turnaround. You know, people are beginning to have to live with the results of the fascism that permeates the American legal system, and they don't like it, and they're looking for an alternative. And when times get hard, something you find throughout all of economic history, what you find is when people get distressed, when they get scared, when they start feeling desperate, they start looking to their heritage, the things that worked in the past, and they They want to cling to their heritage. Well, America has this fantastic advantage over the rest of the world because we've got this revolution of 1776 that was fought over the basic principles of the old common law. And when you look at the Tea Party and all of the, you know, the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian movement, all of these new explosions of interest in the past, what you are watching is the rediscovering of the true American system. Now, I'm not saying that, for instance, the Tea Party has it all right. They're stumbling around. They don't know exactly what to look at to get a good, clear picture of the past, but they're on the march now. They know that there's something fundamentally wrong with America and that the past is the place where you find what needs to be done, the right way to do things.
And so, well, you know, this concept of libertarianism, the listeners that have listened to our shows often have heard me say many times, I don't like to be called a libertarian. I prefer to be called an adult with good manners.
Yes, right. Very good, very good.
And in my opinion, that really defines what a libertarian really is, somebody who's mm-hmm. willing to take care of themselves and maybe others, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, respect the two laws that are really mm-hmm. the foundation of civilization, as you've pointed out. Mm-hmm. So once again, folks, we come to the end of another segment. This is we have one more segment to this particular show. So please stay with us, and we'll be right back with Mr. Richard Mayberry. Talk to you in a minute. Okay, welcome back, everyone. This is Michael McKay, and I have Mr. Richard Mayberry. And so, Richard, so far in this show, we've been talking about how the Roman, ancient Rome and Roman law and the concepts of fascism, where values really don't exist, that it's really whatever the political people think is the authority or is the proper thing to do at any given time is actually completely okay, and how this has corroded our society. And in your other writings, you talk about how the U.S. now is war shopping, which should be evident to anyone who reads the news today. And there's a whole swath of the earth that you refer to in your other writings as chaos stand, where there is no rule of law. Are we entering into the end of the world?
Well, it's a lot of people, you know, find it easy to come to that conclusion because it's a scary time. And, you know, what's happened to me is in the last year or so in writing my newsletter, Early Warning Report, is I've been dragged kicking and screaming to the conclusion that the catastrophe that those of us who believe in liberty and free markets have been predicting for many decades, it's here now. I really hate to say that, but I think it has arrived. And what I try to get across to people in Early Warning Report all the time is that it's not going to last forever. It's not the end of the world. These sorts of things happen all the time in history. Every 50 years or so, maybe every 75 or 100 years, there is some sort of a really big catastrophe. And usually, well, not usually, but very often, it's worldwide. You know, World War I, World War II, the Great Depression, the Civil War was a really big, awful event. It just goes all the way back in history. The French Revolution, the Dark Ages. You know, that one did last a long time. But you know, the rate of change increases constantly, and so things that used to take a century to unwind now, you know, only take 1 year or 2 years or whatever, because the rate of change is so fast. And what you have to do is understand that your ancestors all went through horrible times, some of them really horrible, and you're going to go through a horrible time here too. You already are in it, but no big deal, you know. If you understand it and you know what to do, you're going to get through it with some discomfort, but it's going to be okay. You're going to be fine. Just, you know, keep in mind that you are a member of the most adaptable species on the planet. You are almost infinitely adaptable, and you can handle this. It's going to be bad. It's going to last 5, maybe 10 years, but it's going to be over, and then there's going to be a better world on the other side. And the more people who understand the system of liberty, the faster we're going to get through this, and the more advancement there will be on the other side, the better things will be. So one of the best things you can do is learn all you can about the system of liberty and all of these problems that we were talking about here today, and teach others, tell other people what's really going on, and gather a group around you who understand these things so you can all work together to help each other get through the hard times. And again, you know, keep in mind, this happens. Bad stuff happens all the time throughout history. We're not living here in utopia just because you and I happen to be here right now.
Okay, so Richard, we're going to have to wrap it up. I want to emphasize to everyone that the best resource I know to educate someone on the basics of money, law, and history are the works of Richard Mayberry. Richard, thank you so very much for being with us today. Folks, by the way, go to richardmayberry.com, richardmayberry.com, to obtain information on Mr. Mayberry's works. This is Michael McKay, Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.